From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made in 2007 when some friends were at a barbecue talking about, among other things, life in Uganda and the struggles that Ugandan people face in their daily lives. And a key issue there, access to clean water. That's sort of the simplified version of the story. We're going to get more of it, but the bottom line is that a year later, the team founded the Ugandan Water Project, a nonprofit that works to improve access to water in more than 200 Ugandan communities. The group and its many volunteers help repair broken boreholes, provide water filtration systems, and help educate communities about sanitation and hygiene. This hour, we're going to talk to some of the founders and the people behind the Ugandan Water Project, and three local musicians who are helping work with the group. They're hosting a fundraiser coming up on Saturday at Love and Cup. It's probably going to be packed already, but we'll tell you if you want to go. It'll be fun, a little good music, because they want to build some rainwater collection tanks that is part of the solution there. Let me go ahead and welcome my guest. James Harrington is with the Ugandan Water Project and one of the men behind it. So it's great to see you in person. Hey, nice
great to see you, Evan. Good to be here.
Thanks for being here. Mike and Mel Muscarella are with Violet Mary. Joe Myers as well. So Mel, who does a great job of making sure this stays on my radar. And it's great to see you.
Thank you so much for having us.
It's great to see you back here. We've had a lot of fun talking to Mike, to Mel, about issues related to local music. Joe, nice to see you as well, by the way.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
Joe's the only guy here who doesn't have the street cred of actually having been to Uganda, but no one is perfect. So, and Mike, you want to just let our listeners know who Violet Mary is, by the way?
Sure. Violet Mary is a band based out of Rochester, New York. You can find more about us at violetmary.com or on any of your social media engines. We're just search Violet Mary.
And you might have, were you on Open Tunings today? Is that right?
Yeah. We have monopolized the XXI airwaves.
It is. Had I known about that, I would have canceled this interview. Scott Regan is poaching my territory.
I think it is that way, too.
I am a huge Scott Regan fan and an Open Tuning fan.
So. Yeah, actually, Scott called us and said, "You guys are going on Evan's show, right?" And we said, "Yeah." And he goes, "Come on mine."
Regan. So he's like my Newman. So I'll come talk to you downstairs, Scott, if you're listening. So I want to go back to that, if we could, James, just kind of make sure that I do understand how this all started. And before we even get to sort of that conversation, that barbecue that led to Uganda and water and everything else related to it, tell me a little bit about you. Where are you from?
Yeah, I mean, I'm from, you know, central and western New York. I originally grew up in the Ithaca area and came up here to go to college at Roberts Wesleyan. And after that, graduated, got married, and we eventually ended up back in the Rochester area. And that's where my wife and I are raising our kids. And so that's, you know, more than anywhere else, you know, in my life, the Rochester area has been home now.
And home is Bloomfield, is that right?
Yeah. We actually, you know, we live and run our organization out of Bloomfield. And so, it's actually a point of pride that, you know, this is an organization that is making impact from right here in the Rochester area.
If you go to the website, which is what, by the way?
UgandanWaterProject.com.
If you go to the website, and we'll link to it on Twitter if you want to check that out for an easy link there, you would definitely look at that and think, okay, well, Violet Mary heard about this international organization, mm-hmm. and they're on board. I mean, it's a bit of a surprise to some of us, me included, that it's all really right here.
Yeah, no, it's true. There's so many amazing organizations in this world, and many of them are based in the U.S., and there tends to be these, you know, kind of coalescing hubs in our country that follow these big major metropolitan areas, you know, the Bay Area out on the West Coast and, you know, Boston or New York or Chicago. And yet, you know, we really base right out of this community. And, you know, the way we like to say it is we leverage the values of our hometown to change the world.
So let's kind of get into how we got here, because we just came off Rock the Day, which is this big day of supporting local organizations.
Yeah.
And James, there are some who will argue that before you support organizations and causes around the world, you should fix your own community. And we all know there are issues here. I'm not somebody who necessarily believes that, but I understand it intellectually. How did you end up with your mind on Uganda, for example?
Yeah, absolutely. And first of all, Evan, you know, I agree with that statement in general. I recognize that more of our lives are lived right here. And so it's good that some of us have a global perspective and have our hearts and hands inclined towards the problems in this world. But the way we say it is this, you know, we have a classroom and it's 7,000 miles from here. And so part of what we're doing is serving the needs in Uganda, but part of what we're doing also is engaging people in the work and how to change our world. And it becomes sort of like an educational, transformational experience that people then come back. We've taken about 170 people to Uganda with us as volunteers over the years. And Mike and Mel are two of them. And they can say that they come back ready to engage the issues at home with the same principles that we use overseas. So it's not as separate as some people would think.
Yeah, and in many ways, it just makes you feel more connected to the world where we can oddly, in the world of technology we have, we can still feel pretty isolated and, oh, yeah, I think separated.
That's true.
In many ways. So what happened in 2007? I mean, I kind of touched, yeah, on it briefly, but what really happened?
You know, in 2007, it was in the summer, early summer and Memorial Day, in fact, and I got home from helping a friend with a house project, and I saw a neighbor was having a barbecue, and we've got a great relationship with them, so I crashed that barbecue. They had a bunch of people over, and, you know, I sat down with a plate of food and found myself next to this guy that was clearly from out of town. You know, he was from Uganda. His name was George, and he was he's a pastor and teacher from Uganda that had come for a leadership conference. And we, you know, I just love people from other cultures. I love diversity, and was enjoying a great conversation with him. But one of the things that really impacted me, even in that first conversation, was here's a guy with great education. He's got a master's degree, speaks a couple different languages, dynamic, funny. But if I look at the prospects of opportunity in front of his children versus mine, it's night and day. And some of it comes down to the basic context of everyday life. So even in that conversation, we were talking about the fact that kids in Uganda and his experience growing up and even in his family, they walk for water.
They have to walk for water.
Yep.
You talk about what we take for granted. Yesterday on this program, we talked to refugees who,
right,
you know, just absolutely different lives that, and unless that's your life, it's hard to even imagine it. So how did this progress then for you?
Yeah, even from that first day, there was something that really was bothering me in a very productive way, that this is not putting someone into space. This is not rocket science. This is water. And if there's people living anywhere on the planet, they've figured this out. And so I really felt like, you know, there's something compelling about a need that, you know, from what I could understand, was solvable. This is something that happens every day. It really isn't a problem because we don't know how to solve the water problem or that we don't have the money. It's really this combination of, like you said earlier, there's a certain way of isolation. So, you know, there's an ignorance. And because there's an ignorance, there's an apathy. So it's not that we're all heartless. It's that oftentimes we're focused on other things. But as our awareness grows and as my awareness grew, my heart opened up. And so I spent about, you know, 6 to 10 months just getting to know him and doing research to understand what is this world water crisis all about, and was encouraged to realize that this is a winnable fight. This is something that there are all kinds of solutions. And really what emerged as a first step for us was rainwater collection, because Uganda is an equatorial country. It's on the equator, so they get a lot of rainfall. And it's a very simple solution. It's, you know, there's very few moving parts or pieces. There's no consumable fuels to it. It really is a very simple way that we can help make a quick impact in a community and really transform lives.
Where is Uganda? I know because I made sure I looked it up on a map before coming in here.
Yeah.
You know, but just remind us where Uganda is.
I had to do the same thing,
okay,
after that first conversation. I was like, I'm pretty sure that's not South America. no, it is on the equator, and it's bordered by Kenya, Tanzania, Rwanda, the Democratic Republic of Congo, and South Sudan. So it's kind of, there's a big lake in East Africa called Lake Victoria, the largest lake in Africa. So oftentimes you can see that. And Uganda kind of dominates the northern part of that lake. So if you're looking at a map, those are kind of clues that you'll be looking for.
I recall talking to Todd Moss, who is from Pittsburgh originally and worked in the State Department in 2007 and 8, and now writes thrillers, some of them set in Africa, because he helped direct the State Department's African Affairs. And he says it's just amazing how, well, maybe not amazing, but to him it's stark how Americans have a very small knowledge base of what life is like in Africa.
Yeah.
In other words, a lot of Americans think it is all the same. It's all desert communities. There's kind of hunting and gathering, and it's sort of just this rudimentary that there's no cities. And he said, you know, in snapshots you can find places like that, but we don't understand the continent well enough.
Right.
We don't understand the challenges well enough. Do you agree with that?
Oh, absolutely. You know, it's amazing, because I will say this. There are definitely, whatever you're imagining in your mind right now, all the listeners out there that are thinking, you know, whether it's the bush, whether it's the desert or the jungle, whatever you think of as the quintessential image of Africa, that's there. It's there every day.
Yeah.
And yet there's a whole other side of Africa, in particular Uganda, that, you know, that's what I know so well. I get a solid 4G signal in Kampala.
Kampala, the capital?
Yeah. Okay. So Kampala is the capital city. It's about the size of Rochester geographically, but there's somewhere about 3.5 million people. So it's packed. But you'd be amazed, you know, this really is an exciting decade for Africa. There's so much development that's happening. Now, there's huge portions of the population that are still living in abject poverty. But what's exciting is there's opportunity. The economy is growing. You are starting to see an emerging middle class. They still need a tremendous amount of partnership and help. But I can take you for an amazing meal at a restaurant in Kampala. They're skipping over technological things. You know, they're skipping landlines, going right to cell. They're, you know, mobile banking. There's all kinds of things that are helping to build at an amazing pace.
So how's the government there?
Uganda is an interesting backdrop. You know, it was a British protectorate, and then. Had some real issues with some dictators, obviously the most prominent being Idi Amin from 72 to 78. But for the last, you know, 27 years, there's been a democracy. Now, the president of Uganda has been consistent during that time. And I would say with any good democracy, turnover really proves the democracy, you know, out. So I look forward to seeing that happen.
There's not much turnover. Is that what you're saying?
No, but what's exciting is there is, you know, you're seeing business investment from overseas. You're seeing there's a tremendous entrepreneurial spirit among Ugandans. Roads are getting better. So that's great. Banking is stable and predictable. So there's a lot that's going on. And it's because it's a fairly, you know, stable democracy in the government.
So forgive my ignorance then, but when you go from, say, Kampala, right? Capital,
right, yep.
To the portions of the communities in Uganda that have water challenges, are water challenges essentially everywhere? Is it in more remote parts? Help me work through that.
Yeah, it's really everywhere. It shifts a little bit as to what the major part of the problem is. So for instance, there's piped water available, municipal water supply in the capital city of Kampala. But if you test that water supply, it most of the time that comes back unsafe to drink.
So you even in the capital city.
Yeah. So you still have to treat. You know, we have a compound that we base out of just outside of the capital. We have piped water at our compound. We still have to filter it in order for it to be safe to drink. And so filtration is a big issue within the city. Once you get outside of the capital, and I mean 15 minutes outside of the capital. It drops off quick. Mm-hmm. You're dealing with very rural issues where they don't have piped water. They're dealing with either needing to have a drilled borehole well or catching rainwater or something like that. Many people are still gathering water from what they call a traditional well. And what they call, quote, a traditional well, we would look at and go, oh, that's just a drainage. You know, you dug out a hole at the bottom of a hill, and the water that runs off from the rain just gathers there. And they call that a traditional well.
and it's used.
Every day. I mean, there are millions of Ugandans that gather their water from swamps, rivers, streams, and runoff pits like that.
To state the obvious, issues with disease and health problems.
Yeah, diarrheal disease mm-hmm. and other waterborne diseases that are very preventable are rampant. And, you know, you could empty 80% of the hospital beds in sub-Saharan Africa just by solving the water issue.
So you're hearing about these issues and you're spending time and you're reading and you're learning more. When's the first time you went to Uganda?
That was in the late summer of 2008. And that was quite an experience.
Who'd you go with?
There were six of us on the trip. There was a few friends that helped. You know, we all kind of banded together when we first got this idea and raised the money to, you know, among our friends to fund these first couple of rainwater systems for community buildings there. And so the six of us got on a plane and went over to work with this guy George that I had met. And and also to see these first two rainwater systems installed and understand firsthand how that was going to make change in the communities and just document it and witness it and participate and really to build relationship. That was really the primary motivator was we didn't want this to just be throwing money at something. We really wanted to build a personal connection.
Violet, Mary, I'm going to get back to you guys, but I'm just engrossed with this story.
No, that's okay. We're actively listening.
I meet someone like James, and I'm just so many times we hear about problems in our world, and I'm not at all denigrating most people just like me who you hear about and you go, boy, I wish I could do something. I mean, here you are actually doing something really, really tangible. Yeah. You flew into Kampala that first trip?
Yeah, you know, and it's amazing.
Was it like what you thought?
You know, I like to do my homework, a lot like you, you know. So it wasn't that I hadn't taken time to really do what I can to understand, but there is no substitute for personally showing up. And so I can remember even that first time walking out of the plane. You come out of the plane onto the tarmac, and the warm, moist air is coming off of Lake Victoria, and you can smell a hint of wood smoke in the air and a little bit of diesel. And there's always just a touch. This is like the perfume of Uganda, right? Wood smoke, diesel, and just a touch of burning plastic, you know?
Yep. Burning plastic?
Well, because they burn their trash. And so there's like, you know, and you're just seeing, you see some, you know, a couple of bush planes for DHL, and you see some planes for the UN World Food Program. And you're like, where am I? And you're seeing the Entebbe Airport, which I'm like, I think I've seen this in a couple of movies, and they weren't really great. You know, it was like Siege at Entebbe or something like that. And so, you know, driving from the airport up to the capital, you know, seeing people walking everywhere. Uganda moves at the pace of a walk. You know, everything happens on foot. And just seeing what life is like that close, that granular experience, and of the sights and sounds and smells, and then, you know, eating local food. It was just this amazing experience. And what was interesting, Evan, was we weren't sure how we were going to be able to communicate back with home. You know, we didn't know whether we knew there was internet cafes, weren't sure if we'd be able to make calls or anything. And I got one call through to my wife during the middle of that trip, and it was amazing. There was so much that I was taking in of this amazing culture, the generous, warm-hearted people, the industrious, creative, hardworking people that we were meeting. And as soon as I heard my wife's voice, I just burst into tears because there was just so much that I was filled with by, you know, seeing it all and knowing that at the same time I was both blessed by the generosity and the warmth and the laughter and yet confronted with dramatic need. And it was an amazing experience. And that kind of just one outlet of hearing my wife's voice and knowing I could kind of share that, you know, all of a sudden, you know, it was more than I could process.
That probably comes from, as you say, just when you're able to almost tangibly experience the inequality of the world. I saw a graph recently where, you know, if the world were 100 people, 56 wouldn't have internet. And
right.
How many people would not have clean water? And
exactly.
You know, it is so abstract when you see that and you go, wait, it's just hard to even imagine. We live in a world where we're driving and the car's like, it's 70, but I want it 71. And, you know, it's like, it's just got to be perfect. Uh-huh. And it's so abstract and far away. Do you think that's why the emotion just sort of poured out of you?
Yeah, I think that was part of it. And also just realizing that there's so much that can be done. That building relationships with one another really brings the problems of one another's life and the opportunities and strengths of one another's life together into one conversation. It really isn't that different than what we do here at home. You know, we connect with friends and our lives become necessary to one another by our own choice. And it's powerful to live like that in a community. And I think that was part of what was hitting me was my world got a lot smaller, realizing that we can talk about this here at home in the Rochester area and in Western New York and make some decisions to do things and then see that actually change lives and save lives, and that it doesn't have to be something that takes a year to do. It doesn't have to be something that costs $1 million to do. And we've taken that experience that we had from that very first trip, from those very first two rainwater collection tanks. And that's what we do all the time when we work with people like Violet Mary, when we have a very robust school and campus program where we work with, you know, we love middle schoolers, right? Like we do some great stuff with, you know, we're huge in the sixth grade. we just worked with Sweet Home Middle School out in the Buffalo area in Amherst, and their sixth graders have raised thousands of dollars over the last several years to they've sponsored 15 different water projects. And to show a sixth grader from Western New York that you can hear a story, read a book, and learn about these things, and then go out and just leverage the people around you to help in the little way that they can save thousands of lives for students just like you 7,000 miles away. That student, these, you know, people that are in, you know, groups like Violet Mary or the average family or individual that's listening to this, you're not that far away from making a difference. And, you know, we have the values. We all share these values out of our community. We have the desire to see a change made. We just need sometimes a bridge that we can trust to make it happen effectively and quickly.
Talking to James Harrington, the executive director and founder of the Ugandan Water Project, ugandanwaterproject.com. In our second half hour, we're going to explore exactly what he just said in very very specific ways, because there's not only an event coming up on Saturday, but we're going to talk about other ways that people can understand how they can help if they want to. But before we kind of put a fine point on that, I just want to make sure I understand. You know, you left that first trip, and you want to do, I guess, rainwater collection tanks, which is just part of the solution. But where? I mean, this is a big country, big need. You know, how do you decide how to attack it?
Yeah, you know, and that, again, I keep coming back to it. Relationship is really our heartbeat. And so we started anchoring out from this relationship with George Nsamba, this friend of ours that we had made, and the people that he introduced us to. And we started just with who are the churches, schools, clinics, and orphanages and marketplaces that were connected to him and the people he knew that had a need, and also that showed some evidence that they were ready to serve their community. And we started with that and said, hey, what can we do to tell the stories of the people that we're meeting, and then start with those connections? It's just like this show, right? Connections. It's about the connections, people you meet. And the result was, before we knew it, we had well over 100 potential places that we could be doing work. And it really became, oh my goodness, how can we start raising money? How can we learn how to mobilize mm-hmm. the people here in this community?
How many trips have you taken over the years then?
Oh goodness, it's hard to, it literally is hard for me to count. I'm there 3 or 4 times a year. And in addition to the trips that I've had to make, we also have taken over 20 volunteer teams that represent people that are interested in and connected to our work. So, again, I'm there on a regular basis. I'll be back there for the second half of January. So, looking forward to.
Do you love taking people like Mel, new people, you know, to experience that? Because we're gonna get Mel's take on her first was 2011 for you.
Yeah.
All right. So we're gonna talk about that first trip.
Absolutely.
Is it awesome for you just to see the reaction when people are there for the first time?
It is, and I would say what's the one thing that I love the most about it? It's that it's watching people realize the value exchange. It's an equal exchange of value. We come to help provide clean water, and Uganda overwhelmingly is generous and gives you everything else back. This amazing experience, a rich culture, a huge history. I mean, it is an amazing experience. And to see our volunteers that have given their time and energy and money to come over and be part of it, to see them realize, wow, I'm getting so much more than I feel like I'm giving. That's an amazing experience to see. I feel like the host of The Dating Game, watching people fall in love with a culture.
And what, by the way, what's the route from Rochester to Uganda?
Yeah, there's no direct flights, I'll tell you that.
Yeah.
Of course, in Rochester, we know there's not that many direct flights to anywhere, right?
Right.
We tend to go Rochester to JFK, JFK to Dubai, Dubai down to Entebbe. So it's a full 24 hours of travel to get there. And sometimes it's stretched over 2.5 days if the routes are packed, you mm-hmm. know?
And what's the languages there?
Yeah, you know, the great thing about Uganda is the national language is English, and I actually speak a little English, and so that works out really well.
Yeah.
There's 42 local languages.
Wow,
there's
yeah.
about 3 or 4 prominent ones. Luganda is probably the primary.
Luganda, you said?
Yeah, Lugandan. Mm-hmm. Alternative to English, but the official language is English. The education system is in English, and so what's exciting is in a room of Ugandans, a third of them are going to speak fluent English. A third are going to be able to understand, and you can work out a conversation. And then a third need a translator. But it really is a place that so often you can show up, you get out of the van, and you can connect.
And what is one aspect of culture, even in just daily life, could be meals, could be greetings, whatever. Every country has its own different ideas on, you know, sort of the rhythms of life. What's
sure.
one thing that you have learned about Uganda that you did not know before you were there?
Yeah, you know, I love how they really make connecting with one another is such a central part of having a meal together. You know, I love sitting down and connecting around food, and they really, you know, they're just so generous, even if they don't have much. And just this idea that, you know, we're Americans. We're doing 100 things at once at any given time. In Uganda, there's so much focus because when you sit down together, that's your world, is who's in front of you. And so it really has taught me a lot about how to really focus on who's in front of me and really to pay the respect and honor of just the value of your life, Evan, of sitting down and talking to you and tuning out the rest of these people in the room. No, just kidding.
they're like the ultimate no cell phones at the dinner table kind of place.
Yeah. In many ways, that's what it's really taught me.
So let's get our only break of the hour and come back and talk about what's coming up, how you can help if you want, and we'll get to our other guest's take on their experience and what they make of this remarkable Ugandan Water Project. It's UgandanWaterProject.com. James Harrington is the executive director and founder, and Mel, Mike, and Joe from Violet Mary, the band supporting it, and you're going to hear from them next. I'm Evan Dawson. Thursday on The Next Connections, Planned Parenthood joins us. They're talking about life in a Trump administration and what that could mean for the future of Roe v. Wade. The president-elect says, well, if it's overturned, women can just go across state lines to get abortions. What will that really mean in practice? We'll talk about it. Then in our second hour, Monroe County Executive Cheryl Dinolfo sits down to talk about the recent budget and other issues in Monroe County. All right, welcome back to Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. I think as we talk about what's coming up and what the Ugandan Water Project is doing next, I think it's valuable just to ask James in general, do you set annual budgets? You know, how much are you raising for the individual tanks? And then beyond the rainwater collection, you know, what exactly are you doing?
Yeah, absolutely. We always dream big. We set big goals because we expect to be part of making a big impact. And so this year, you know, for the last several years, we've implemented about 50 major projects a year. And this year, we're hoping to have our biggest year yet with about 60 to 70 projects ending up by the end of the year. It's exciting to see who chooses to partner with us throughout the year to make that happen, because it's the ultimate gamble on our values. We believe that people want to make a difference and that we can partner with them to help make that happen. But at the beginning, every January, we don't know who's going to be coming alongside us.
All right. And the sort of the 101 on clean water systems, you know, you're doing rainwater collection, but it's one thing to collect rainwater. What do you have to do with it? How do you sort of distribute? What's the 101?
Yeah, the real simple way that we say is, you know, we've got to get it so it's potable, so it's safe to drink. And really the standard we hold ourselves to is, if I wouldn't give it to my children, then we're not done. And so with rainwater systems, we capture rain off of community building roofs and put them in a big plastic tank. And then we terminate with a water filter, and it's a hollow fiber membrane. It's the same technology, actually, that's used for dialysis. And that filters down to 0.1 microns. And that really removes the bacterial elements and any of the biological problems that we'd be concerned about. And it would pass the EPA standard for drinking water here in the U.S. So for a rainwater system, that's how we finish. For any area where they already have a water supply and they just need to get it potable, we also distribute those filters for household or classroom use. And then for drilled wells, we limit ourselves to focusing on wells that are deep enough that they're working with water that has been filtered through the ground. Usually you have to go 60 to 80 feet before you really are into a safe aquifer. And that water, we always test it too, to make sure. So you can treat it with chlorine, but Ugandans, we're used to that, but Ugandans generally don't like the taste of that. So we focus on point of use filtration.
Last year, you raised more than $5,000, I think, with Love and Cup Night. Is that right?
Yeah, absolutely. It was an amazing night, wasn't it?
It was really great. Yeah. We went into the night hoping to raise enough money for one tank, which is roughly $3,600. And that was sort of our public goal. Yeah, one tank, we're going to raise that. But our private goal was about $5,000, and we hit $5,200, and everyone was cheering, and people were crying, myself included.
it was
very exciting.
So Mel Muscarella from Violet Mary, Saturday, the next go-round is on Saturday. It's at the Love and Cup in Henrietta. Mm-hmm. Starting when?
6 o'clock.
6 o'clock. Mm-hmm. Open to the public.
Yes.
And you're going to try to raise how much this time?
This year, we're shooting for $8,000. So
and that'll do what?
That'll be enough for two rainwater collection tanks and just a few little miscellaneous things after that. I think that definitely covers the cost of two tanks.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, we'll install rainwater systems on two schools and put a water filter in every classroom of those two schools for that $8,000.
Nice.
Yeah, that's really remarkable. So that is on Saturday at Love and Cup. James, Mel, Mike, Joe, if people can't go on Saturday, I know there are ways that they can help if they want to. What would you tell them?
Well, we've been doing some preliminary fundraising for the event, and that happens through UgandanWaterProject.com/2tanks. Or just on the front page of Violet Mary's website, there's a big logo with a donation button. And we've had local companies and individuals who've been donating already to start that ball rolling. So if you can't attend the event, you can still be a part of the solution. You're not restricted by just one night and being in a location. That's the best way.
UgandanWaterProject.com/2tanks.
Two tanks.
Okay. Or violetmary.com?
Or violetmary.com right on the front of the page.
Okay. Mel, your first trip there was 2011, right?
Correct.
Because you've been there in 11 and 14, and Mike, yours was
just 14.
Okay. Kind of take me through how you ended up understanding what was going on and deciding to go.
So my connection with James actually happened through his roommate is the pastor at our church, so college roommate. So James came to Artisan and we were like, wow, that's incredible. We definitely want to help give some money to this. And I didn't really think anything much other than, like, I'd like to help. And I can't go there, so I'm just going to give some money, you know. And then my friend Liz, who was also part of Artisan at the time, went with her school. And she came back and she said, that was great. I'm going to go again. Do you want to come? And I said, sure. And then I had no idea what I had just gotten myself into. I just answered right away. I'm like, wow, an African adventure. How wonderful. That was in May of 2011, and the trip was set for August. The team that was leaving in August, Liz and I had to split our time a little bit differently. She couldn't go, and neither could I. I had just started a new job, so we both couldn't go at the same time. So we left a week after. So we spent one full week with the team that James had been leading at the time. And then we stayed on a whole week after that. There was a documentary team that we were traveling with, and Liz was also doing some master's work for her master's degree at the time, too. So we sort of stayed after as like a 5-person team. And we went up into the northern part of the country at that time, which was really, I had no time while we were in the southern part of the country felt uncomfortable or unsafe. And then when we went to the northern part of the country, it was very uncomfortable. it was a whole different environment up there.
Uncomfortable, why?
So in the southern portion of the country, everything that James was saying about, yeah, everybody is so welcoming and warm, just the whole entire dynamic felt different to me. So we would go up there, and I think people felt a little bit more wary of us. And I don't know if, and this is maybe part of my own ignorance, I'm not sure if that part of the country gets a lot of traffic from other parts of the world. So the kids were in the south, they would run following the bus, you know, pointing at us and being very excited that there were visitors to their town. In the north, the kids would just kind of watch us pass by, and they were a little bit tentative and wary is a good word.
You want to weigh in on that, James?
Yeah, you know, it's interesting because northern Uganda experienced 26 years of civil war under the LRA. That was a lot of the stories we heard in the press about child soldiers and things like that and abductions was happening in northern Uganda. And so it's a very traumatized part of the country that has taken a long time, even though the LRA was pushed out of Uganda in 2007, 2008, even in 2011, there's just still such an awareness of and a bruise on the culture up there from suffering for decades, and so definitely there, you know, it's not the same warm welcome, even though when you connect personally, once you can break through that the apprehension, you still see the warmth, but it takes a lot longer, and so definitely a different experience. And it is a different, you know, the tribal culture is a little different than in the central region. So,
but I did have to say that when we were up there and we had sort of made our connection with the people that we were with, I'm a dental hygienist by trade, so I got to do a couple of education clinics, which was interesting and fun. And I said some weird things, but it was great.
You said some weird things?
This is kind of Mel's thing, even in the band. It's, you know, her role is singing, playing keyboard, writing songs, and saying weird things. So.
That's right. It's part of my job description. So, you know, when I was doing the dental hygiene clinic, I had a little girl come up and she was very excited to translate for me. So I, you know, my big hope was that the things that I was saying were getting across, but she was so eager and she was 8 and her name was Ruth and she was beautiful. And so that was a really, and I have a great picture in my office now of all the kids holding their toothbrushes and we're all having a good time. So, I would agree with that. Once you sort of broke through that initial thing, but then when we were with the film crew, we would walk out and they were in search of people to talk about their experience with, you know, their own water, lack of water, and what their lives were like. And so we were just sort of walking up to people's homes and asking, hey, can we put you on film? And so they were a little bit, you know, it was a little awkward for them, but we finally kind of had a couple people who were really excited to talk about it and to go on film. Some people didn't want to be even on camera. That was a little bit superstitious for them, so they weren't willing to do that. But then we did find some families that were willing to talk about it, and they were really awesome.
How long was that trip for you in 2011?
2 weeks.
2 weeks.
Mm-hmm.
And you came home saying what about Uganda and your world?
I came home definitely with a different perspective of the just immense wealth, no matter how much money I have, it's always way more, and I have the ability to just access pretty much anything I want anytime I want it. Just the kind of realization that to be taken out of this world and to be placed into a world where that's not the reality, and even to have, as James was saying, something as simple as just getting a drink of water, that we just so much take for granted is it's really eye-opening and sobering and humbling. And so I came back definitely with a different view of life in general and what human life means and what my connection is to people who are, you know, not now I have this personal connection to people who are so far away from me and their life is every bit as valid as mine and how incredible that is.
It's like having a separate world within the same planet. And I mean this not sort of humorously, but seriously. If an intelligent civilization landed on our planet, and say they landed in rural Uganda, and that was their experience for a few days, and then they took off and left, they'd say, beautiful, remarkable, they don't have, you know, a lot of clean water. Whereas if they landed in, I don't know, Utah, they'd go up and say, wow, you know, Rochester, whatever it is. Mm-hmm. It's just amazing that in the same world, the experience can be so different.
Absolutely.
Day to day. But did you feel that this is sort of doable, that these problems can be tackled?
Yeah, you see it happening. You know, the exciting part, and I think I may have mentioned this in my email, when we raised the money for the tank last year, our date was December 5th, and we had confirmation that a tank had been built before Christmas. So it, you know, it's so fast. It happens right away as fast as it can. And then to go, you know, on that first trip, our purposes were a little bit different. The way the second trip worked, we were more involved with site visits, potential site visits, and then making sure that places that had tanks, that the tanks were working properly, that they were clean, and that everybody knew how to make sure that they were keeping everything clean so they could work and learning how to use the water filters. So you're seeing this in action. So it totally, this is a situation that's completely doable when you see it in action. And it's really incredible to see a little girl come up with her little jerry can, turn on the little faucet, and fill up her jug with water that is safe for her and her family. So, she didn't have to travel miles to get it through unsafe territory, and she didn't have to share that water with whatever animals were in their region.
Before I turn to the other side of the room, I want to grab a phone call. Wendy in Rochester has a question for the panel. Go ahead, Wendy.
Hi there. Before I ask my question, I want to comment that sometimes I had the experience when I was in Kenya that people don't want their picture taken, not because they're superstitious, but because they're aware that Africans are often portrayed in ways that don't please them.
Yes,
sure.
In Western media, so they're not. It's not like some kind of primitive superstition. It's a modern consciousness of what
you're absolutely right.
What can happen? The other thing is, but what I wanted to ask was, in going to Uganda, I have a friend who came back a couple of years ago from being in Gambia on a mission sort of thing where she was working. And she was really impressed with how water is really an issue there and part of its deforestation. And I wonder if you're seeing any climate issues in Uganda. It's different there. It's on the equator, so it's not maybe as dry. But are they experiencing changes in their rainfall? Is climate change having an effect on their water supply?
Yeah. Thanks, Wendy. James here. And first of all, I completely agree with you. One of the things that is one of the tenets of our organization at the Ugandan Water Project is we don't sell misery. We are huge advocates and spokespeople for the hope and the bright future of East Africa. And so I really am glad that you highlighted that about photographs and things, because, you know, we don't you know, celebrate distended bellies and flies in the eyes and things like that. We really say, you know, we believe in a shining light that on the horizon for Uganda and Ugandans, and they are amazing people. So that's awesome. As far as climate change goes, it's a real issue in different ways. In particular, the growing population of Uganda. There's so much of life that has been real challenging for the environment. In particular, what we see is. So much of the housing is built out of brick, which is made by hand and fired with firewood. And so as the need for housing has exploded, you're seeing massive deforestation. And so some of the organizations that we partner with, where they're doing one aspect of community development and we're handling water, sanitation, and hygiene, there's some great organizations focusing on how to build with materials where you don't have to fire the bricks. You can use compression and stabilization to create bricks and things like that. So we're not seeing a massive shift in the climate in terms of you still have rainy seasons and dry seasons, but we are seeing, you know, certain aspects of a stressed climate.
Well, thank you for that. Vision.
Well, thank you, Wendy. Thanks for the phone call. We're talking about the Ugandan Water Project, ugandanwaterproject.com. James Harrington, who you just heard, is the executive director and founder. And that founding goes back to, I guess, do you formally say 2008 is when it was officially started?
Yeah, we really started as 2008 because we really didn't know what we were doing in 2007. But we actually had work done in 2008. So we could say there's definitely a beginning point there.
If you want to go out to Love and Cup on Saturday night, you can hear... Well, one more time, Mel and Mike, what's the rundown, Joe, on Saturday night?
Well, Mike, you'll have to forgive me because he just told me the name of the – we just booked an opening acoustic act.
The Jasper Stills.
Thank you very much.
Great. Oh, yeah.
They are fabulous.
They are very good.
Yeah, I didn't know the name because there are a couple of friends of ours that perform solo, but they also do a duo performance. So they're opening the night roughly around 6 o'clock, 6:15, mm-hmm. something like that. So as people kind of – you know, come in, they're going to be performing, entertaining people. And then Junkyard Field Trip will be playing after them. And they're also good friends of ours, local musicians who've been in the music scene for years. And they're wonderful. And they will be performing 9 o'clock, 9:30, somewhere around that time. So there's plenty of live music all night long.
But there's also raffles and games and... participatory things for attenders as well, because the whole point of the evening is less about the music and it's more about these two tanks. Because, you know, we can throw a concert whenever we need to for our own purposes. That's totally fine. This particular thing is about these two schools and these two tanks and giving them water. That's the key.
So three different musical performances, mm-hmm. yeah? You know who would know all those guys? Scott Regan.
Yeah.
He would. Regan. Every one of them.
Yeah.
That guy knows everything. Mike Muscarelli, yeah. Your first trip, your only trip to Uganda.
Yes.
I say only.
Thus far.
Yeah, no. 2014, right?
2014.
And Can you kind of take me through in the same way that, that Mel did?
Sure.
What was your expectation going? Because obviously at this point, you're hearing from so many people. You've got the perspective of, right. of seeing a little bit more. But what did you expect and what did you experience?
Well, my previous day job was on staff at that same church. And so I remember the day where I met James and we had hot dogs in the back 40. And he told us about this crazy plan. And we all were very impressed because we'd have a number of NGOs who would come to us and say, you know, we want you to partner with us to do some world-changing stuff. And it always seemed to be this big organization where most of the money is going to be bottlenecked into the organization and very little of it's going to make it to the people. And here's this guy in his garage. And we thought, well, that sounds pretty good. That sounds our speed. Let's see what he does. And so we partnered with him early on and did several tank fundraisers and saw the fruits of that, which was fun. And then when Mel came back, watching her process the whole experience was kind of what pushed me over the edge. I knew, yeah, I'm going to go. I don't know when, but I'll go. And so James wrangled me into two roles while I was there. I had to teach schoolmasters how to use the filtration system, how to keep it clean and how to use it. And then I also was responsible for playing music. And so I told James I would gladly go, but I'm not going to take my beautiful Taylor acoustic guitar because I'm nervous about it and I don't know what to expect. And he says, it'll be fine, in a wonderful James kind of way. It'll totally be fine. Don't worry about it. Until we land in Entebbe Airport, and the only piece of luggage that did not make it to Entebbe, the only one, my Taylor was still in Dubai. The only thing worse was if Mel was still in Dubai. The look of complete horror on my face, and he's like, he had to talk me off the ledge. Don't worry, we'll get it. It'll be here tomorrow. It'll be totally fine. And I'm still picking clay dust out of that case. I love it to death. It's fabulous.
But did you did get it the next day?
Oh yeah. Yeah, we got it the next day.
So ultimately, was James right? Weren't you glad you had Taylor there?
Oh yes. Well, in some
I don't know if you've named it anything besides your Taylor.
But... Yes. It's my precious. actually yes, because we did have 3 days where we were staying in host homes. Mm-hmm. And our particular host home, we heard from the other members of the team, was like the Hyatt Regency comparatively, but it was in the middle of the bush, and there were about a dozen people that lived in and around this house that all kind of came together when we arrived, and there was only one of them that spoke English, and that English was rudimentary at best. It was probably definitely an adult intellect, but language ability was like a first grader. Mm-hmm. And they saw that I had a guitar, and that became our communicative thing.
That's great.
They wanted to hear me play because he wanted his sons to dance for me, and he wanted some music. And I turned to Mel and I said, "What should I play? I don't know. I know one."
That's a great question.
I know one Ugandan song, and Mel says, I don't know, play anything.
Yeah.
You know, they hardly speak the language. You could play anything.
So what did you do?
Well, we played a lot of Allman Brothers. played some Beatles.
Yeah.
And when we played the Beatles, the kids were doing this dance, and the father looks at me very excited, and he says, "Is this twist?" And I had to have him repeat it. I was like, I don't know what you just said. And Mel... caught
twist
it.
And show?
Is this the twist, what they were doing?
The twist.
And Mel says, almost. And she demonstrates how to do the twist. And so we play the twist.
That's great.
And, you know, like that guitar became our universal translator.
That's awesome.
Yeah. It was fantastic.
Is there anything Mel doesn't do?
No.
The twist as well there.
But the thing that I have to share, though, going along with James's thing, is I left there knowing that I was very welcome. Mm-hmm. And that blew my mind, that I walked into the stranger's house as an other, but the first thing out of his mouth was, "You are most welcome." And, you know, we live in a condo and I'm attached to my neighbor and I don't know his name. And I've lived there for 10 years, you know, and I went into the stranger's house and I was most welcome. And I knew it from the moment I arrived. Mm-hmm.
All right, before I lose the hour, Joe, you're going to go? You're going to go eventually?
It's been a discussion. Yeah, we're looking for an opportunity. But then
these stories are amazing.
But then this summer, James told me that there were these two types of poisonous snakes, and I was like, oh man, like it's a setback. But no, I have to tell you, when I first joined Violet Mary, I think it was when Mike and Mel had just returned home from their 2014 trip, and Mike says, I got to tell you this story, and probably don't have time to get into it now, but anyway, the experience that they shared with me was just so incredible. I mean, I was just starting, you know, to play music with them as their drummer, but this passion, this energy was so alive and well with their trip to Uganda that it was just palpable. It was amazing, and so I've kind of been involved in one way or another ever since then.
Mm-hmm. Well, let me just ask James then to sort of finish the hour for us. We're down to about our last 40 seconds, James, as the executive director and founder of the Ugandan Water Project. If you continue to have success in 5-10 years, what's different? What do you expect to achieve here?
I hope to be unemployed.
Not needed anymore there?
Yeah, I'll be honest. I think more NGOs need to really start with an end in mind. As far as the water crisis globally, it's still a long fight. But, you know, people often say that, like, Uganda seems to be gaining traction, doing well. Why not focus somewhere else? And I'm like, because we need to win in Africa. We need to solve this. And so I look and say, if we don't, if people still continue to come alongside us at the pace that we're growing with the other partners that are doing similar work, we should be out of a job. And so that's what I would say.
We should be kicking with Violet Mary music. That was the host's fault, by the way. But that's okay. That's all right. Yeah. VioletMary.com to check out their work, which you should do anyway, but also to check out if you want to donate and contribute to the Two Tanks Project, or UgandanWaterProject.com/two tanks. But I think if you just go to UgandanWaterProject.com, you get a sense for exactly what I felt. You're going to want to read the stories in the background. It's beautifully done. And James, I just admire you so much. Thank you for being here.
It's been great being here.
It's awesome to hear these stories. And Violet Mary, great seeing all you guys as well.
Always good to see you.
Keep up the great work here. Our thanks to Rob Braden, the engineer. Megan Mack is the producer. Scott Regan, my spirit animal from downstairs. Regan. We love you, Scott. And thanks for listening. We'll talk with you Thursday on Member Supported Public Radio.